All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm speaking to you from Queens, the borough of Queens in the city of New York. This is the 14th day of September 2021. I do like to remind you I am the author of a newsletter called Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks. You can sign up for that by going to miningstocks.com. ChenPicks.com is the place to go to pick up on Chen Lin's excellent letter. Focus is on biotechs and the mining shares, as well as sometimes the energy shares. And then there's Michael Oliver, who's with us today. It's OliverMSA.com for his excellent letter, momentum and structure analysis letter that is very unique. It is one of a kind, and it has been very, very good for us and for me in particular as I try to hold steady with my investments and not get whipped in and out by the emotions of markets. But Michael has really been very helpful to us, and I'm glad to say he'll be with me in just a couple of minutes from now. And, of course, I want to thank all of you for sending along your questions, for listening to this show, and for sending along your thoughts and questions to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com, questions@gmail.com. And our sponsors for this week that make this show possible: Novo Resources, LOO Resources, Hannon Metals, Labrador Gold Corp, Lion One Metals, SK Mining Corp, and Firefox Gold. I've titled today's show, Crescat's Macroeconomic Case for Gold. Michael Oliver, as I said, is with us. Quentin Henning will return, and he'll be with me in the second segment. And then Kevin Smith and Octavio Tavi Costa visit for the first time. They're with Crescat Capital. At a time in Western culture when individuals are told to stop thinking and simply follow orders, Kevin and Tavi have demonstrated that if you want to avoid following the lemons into the sea, using your God-given intelligence can allow you to rise far above the norm. Starting with Kevin and his wife Linda in 1992, the legacy of a highly profitable Crescat Capital began. In 2013, Tavi Costa, it's another individual thinker, joined Crescat, where he has built the company's macroeconomic model. Kevin and Tavi will explain the company's investment philosophy and why their macroeconomic model demands investing in gold exploration companies, and they'll be with us during the second half of today's show. Not surprisingly, the independent thinking of Crescat's team was attracted to the skills of another exceptionally talented, most out-of-the-box thinking geology, perhaps, that I know of anyway, Dr. Quentin Henning. Although he had been advising Crescat regarding their investments in mineral exploration companies, Quentin recently joined Crescat in a formal position as technical advisor. Those of you who listen to this show on a regular basis know that I have an extremely high regard for Dr. Henning, not only for his geological insights and his ability to explain geology to lay folks to help them understand what might otherwise seem ununderstandable, but I also have a very high regard for his integrity. So I believe the addition of Dr. Henning to Crescat's team are a good reason for Crescat's gains in their precious metals hedge fund of 235% from August 1st of 2020 to July 31st of this year, and that took place despite a pretty weak gold share market the last number of months. So congratulations, and we will be learning more from both, from Kevin Smith and Tavi Costa in the second half of today's show. Quentin will be with me as well today during the second segment to talk about SK Mining, and that's a really exciting story, a project that looks to be the spitting image of the SK Creek mine, which is one of Canada's wealthiest, highest grade mines ever. So we'll look forward to hearing from Quentin right after our first commercial break. But right now, I'm really happy to tell you that Michael Oliver is with us again. Thanks for joining me, Michael.
Hi, Jay. Good to be back.
Always good to have you. You know, I'm just thinking about it. This is a complete Colorado day. You live in Colorado. Dr. Henning lives in Colorado. And our friends from Crescat live in Colorado. So I guess this is, we should have called this a day for Colorado or something like that. But in any event, it's a state that is, I saw just recently, a state that's considered to be the second most popular state to retire in. After Florida, so I thought that was interesting. Anyway, getting to your to the topic at hand here, in your weekend missive, actually in the Gold, Silver, and Mining letter, as well as your 360-degree weekend report, both of those were headed with the title Stock Market and Gold. Now, I can't remember you using the same title for both letters in the past anytime. So are you saying that you think we may be very close to a transition? Because you've been talking about this transition in asset classes away from equities towards gold and treasuries for some time. Do you think this is starting to happen now?
Yeah, I think so. If you look at an S&P chart, for example, forget the momentum aspects is what we look at, but even if you just look at a price chart of the S&P, over the last several months, its rise has been what we call a zombie walk. It's just like sleepwalking. It's so incremental that it's almost not real. It doesn't even look like an S&P chart anymore, you know, with some ups and downs and that kind of thing. It's just like there's no downs at all, but there's also the upside is measured in, you know, decimals. And, in one bad day, you could wipe out 3 months of sleepwalking. And we're attempting to do that right now. But so that the slowness in the advance indicates, the buyers are still winning. But somebody is distributing consistently, and we see it more particularly in the leadership of the market, and that still is NASDAQ 100 and Microsoft, Amazon, and Apple, which we're highly focused on. We think the intermediate trend is down. We think it's turned down. Intermediate meaning the kind of thing that could, you know, it's a trading type situation, not for a few days, but probably for a few weeks, maybe a month or two. But the problem is, if you get an intermediate trend decline that goes, you know, several more percent lower, you're going to start to engage or break longer-term momentum trend factors, in which case you might wave goodbye to the top. Now, we're not looking for a March event like last year, you know, where everybody's pulling their hair out and margin calls and they're selling anything and everything. We're looking for a typical top, which is the norm is that you have a fighting situation. Go back and look at the 2000 top. Go back and look at the 2007 top. And you won't see a collapse. You'll see an arm wrestling match, which ultimately goes lower. That's what we think we're headed for. But I think there's a lot of asset managers who appreciate that notion and have been starting to move assets out of stocks, which they perceive to be higher risk, less reward now, after what's gone on for the last dozen years, and moving it into T-bonds just for safety, not because for yield, certainly.
No.
But it's, you know, it's like cash. You move it over to cash. Well, they'll buy T-bonds, 10-year, 30-year, that kind of thing. And they're buying gold. Now, if you go back and look at T-bonds, I don't think ultimately that relationship will hold up. I think T-bonds will ultimately turn down. Yields will go up again. But for now, they're still an alternative to the stock market. Therefore, when you start to see bonds firm, it means somebody's buying them and probably exiting stocks at the same time. But notice when bonds made their low, back in March. When did gold make its low? Back in March. So there's a coincidence there. Admittedly, gold probed back down toward that low in early August with that panic selling in the dark. But it lasted a few minutes, actually. It was a few-minute phenomenon. And gold's now, you know, 1805 today. So that low in March was 1673. But anyway, so the fact that bonds and gold are firming, even if irregularly, to the point where people don't quite get the sense that they're firming, that means money's moving into them and moving out of, I think, stocks. And I think now you're starting to see breakage in stocks that indicates that it's not just slowing the advance in stocks, the selling, but it's actually starting to break them down. We've got specific numbers, and we're focused on what we think we need to focus on, which is to say the leadership. And by leadership, I mean the symbols that constitute, you know, 20-30% of the major indexes. And, and the three I just mentioned are three of them. You could add Google and Facebook.
Sure.
When you have weightings like these symbols have that are so heavy, you can take 100 other stocks and they don't even balance Apple or Amazon or Microsoft in terms of the weighting within the index. So we think if they break, and we think they're now in the intermediate downtrend, we've got levels not far below that they'll break annual momentum uptrends. They go back a dozen years, which means we're in a bear market at that point. And I think at that point, that's when gold and T-bonds will get even more oomph on the upside. We've got some numbers on gold and silver that we adjust down each week or each quarter, depending on which metric we're using, that say, okay, we're coming out of here. By the, coming out of here, I mean coming out of this clump of ink that we've seen for the last 13 months, where gold was, you know, 2,000 down to below 1,700, and now it's sort of in the middle of that. Silver's between like 30 and 22, and now it's sort of in the middle of that. That there are levels that will break out upside that will indicate we're going through the top of those zones. And it won't require price getting back up near the top of those zones. It will require very little. In fact, I'd say just throw out a number, you get up in the upper 25s again on silver, like a buck or so above this week's high, it's coming out of here. In the case of gold, for the rest of this quarter, that means only next 2 weeks, by the way, 1865 will do the job, but you get into next quarter and you see gold up in the 1830s again. If you look at a price chart, we've been pushing up into that zone repeatedly in the last few months. You go back up there one more time and it happens to be in the fourth quarter, you're coming out of here, upside. So anyway, we're on edge here for that upside breakout, which we think is pending. And the question is it going to occur before next quarter, or are we going to fumble around here and work our way to it in October, which is
in the
fourth
quarter. With a minute left here, Michael, how's silver looking to you now?
I still like silver over gold, and I like what silver's been doing. Unlike gold, silver never took out. You know, gold made a low back in November in the 1700s and then blew it out in March. Silver never did that. Silver made its first pullback low in September of last year, 6 weeks after the high. It had been up to 30 almost and dropped to 2190-something 6 weeks after the high. You've never come back and taken out that low. You've been between that high and that low ever since. And right now we're, you know, 24-something. So it's a confusing price-looking situation because you, when you look at the price chart, you think, well, gee, silver's got to go up to 30 again before it breaks out. No, it doesn't. We think at upper 25 will do the job.
All right. Silver bigger on the upside and
bigger on the upside percent-wise than gold, yes.
And bigger on
and
the downside.
Also, the miners, which everybody is so frustrated by.
Yes, we sure are.
They will, they'll suddenly become stronger than gold.
They'll lead gold up, you think?
I think once you get gold and silver through our numbers, that the miners will suddenly engage in a way that percent-wise is, will drop jaws. They'll regain leadership again quickly. Well, yesterday was a good example. Silver was down a bit, gold up a bit, and the miners are up 3% or so.
Yeah, no, that's true. The major miners,
yeah.
Very good. Well, 30 seconds left. Just a real quick one on uranium. I mean, are you uranium is breaking out. I mean, has broken out, right?
Do you see it? We've been bullish for a couple of years, and we've crossed over some major numbers. I think you're going to go above 44, which is a price high it made several years ago. Not the highest high, but a prominent price high. I don't think it's going to stop until you blow that out. But I'll tell you what I like the most. It's natural gas.
Really?
I think natural gas, which is, we had multiple breakouts on it, and our final one was around 440. It's now 530. We think it's going to $9 and probably quickly.
Well, I guess if
and we think it's going to occur during the winter here, which, of course, makes sense. But that is not good news for folks for to get a doubling in their heating bill.
Yeah, inflation is on the rise, no doubt about that. Yeah, and that and can't be good. That can't be good
for monetary policy. This is government energy policy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I guess maybe real deep down inside, AOC is bullish on natural gas, and she wants to make a lot of money.
Yeah.
Maybe she's long gas, natural gas.
She
who knows?
Probably is.
Yeah, who knows? Let's stay away from politics. It's so ridiculous, so nonsensical. So let's just stick to the numbers, and that's what you do with your momentum and structure analysis. Michael, thank you so much for being with us. Again, it's always a pleasure to have you. All righty, folks, so we do have to go to break, but don't go away. Dr. Quentin Henning will be with us to talk about SK Mining. It's a really exciting story, so don't go away. We'll be right back with Quentin Henning.
Firefox Gold is actively exploring in Finland, where recent discoveries have sparked a new gold rush. Firefox controls a major portion of a prospective gold belt, giving the company a distinct advantage for exploration and strategic partnerships. The company's strong international leadership team, combined with its Finland-based exploration specialists, will put Firefox on the crest of the coming wave of gold discoveries. Firefox Gold trades on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol FFOX. Go to firefoxgold.com to subscribe for updates.
SK Mining Corp, trading under the symbol ESK on the TSX Venture and ESKYF on the OTCQB, is a mineral exploration company targeting precious metals, rich VMS deposits in the heart of British Columbia's Golden Triangle. SK Mining controls a prospective land package totaling 130,000 acres, which lies across a geologic trend that once hosted the prolific SK Creek Mine. With a world-renowned geological team, funding in place, and shareholders such as Eric Sprott, SK Mining is on the cusp of a world-class discovery. Go to skmining.com to subscribe for updates.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really happy to tell you that Dr. Quentin Henning is back with us once again. This time he's going to talk to us and give us an update on SK Mining Corp. Trades in Toronto under ESK. In the United States, you can buy it under ESKYF. 162.5 million shares, and when I checked on it earlier today, around 2 o'clock, it was trading in U.S. money at $1.65. This is a company that I think you want to keep your eyes on. It's one that I believe could provide spectacular outcome based on what we know so far, and well, based on what I think I know so far. But we're really glad to have Quentin with us again to give us an update. Thanks for joining me, Quentin.
Absolutely, Jay. Good to speak.
It's really good to have you. And also, for those that might not be familiar with this project, it is what is known as a VMS. Deposits, volcanic massive sulfides, deposits that are created on the, as you've explained many times, created on the ocean floor, and then sometimes due to tectonic action, they are thrust up into the mountains, as is the case with SK's project, SK Mining's project, in just south of the wonderful, really, I guess one of the richest mines in Canadian history, the SK Creek Mine. So, what can you tell us now about the, you've had a very, very favorable, I mean, almost spectacular first season drill program there last year. I'm looking at, I think, one of the headline numbers from the assays that were released in February of this year, 35.5 meters of 9.5 grams of gold and another 70 grams per ton of silver. What have you learned from last year's drill program and subsequent work that you've been doing on the ground? And perhaps what have you learned from this year's, not from the assays yet, but you've done a lot of drilling. I think you said something like two-thirds of the drill program now, 20,000 meters or so. So can you give us anything new, anything we might learn today from what you know so far?
Certainly. Look, we put out an update a couple of weeks ago, but I can give a little bit further update here. We are about two-thirds of the way through the current drill program. We've targeted a minimum of 30,000 meters. We'll probably end up doing a bit more than that, probably closer to 35,000 meters by the end of the season. The crews are doing very well. We got four rigs operating. And the team is basically swimming in core at this point. They have got just absolutely oodles and oodles of core piled up. The program will last until about the third week in October. That's usually when the weather turns decidedly south. But, it varies from year to year. It might go a little longer. Who knows? It is going exceptionally well. The drilling at TV and Jeff are nearing completion, basically, and now the drills are testing other targets. We've been testing the area to the south, what's called C10, and they've identified some new sulfide occurrences in that area in outcrop. Last year we talked about one, which was called Spearhead, but the team is recognizing further sulfide targets down there. So being light on their feet, they're going to try testing a few of these with the drill bit, which is very exciting. So we've got quite a robust program going now at C10. And then the other drills are going to work on testing some of these sulfide targets, or what we perceive as sulfide targets, peripheral to the TV Jeff area. Mm. Got a number of them identified. These are basically going to be wildcat holes from here on out, testing new areas. But that's also quite exciting. I guess to summarize what I would say, what we're seeing right now is actually a remarkable, clear, concrete evidence that this is all VMS related. We see the mineralization of TV Jeff being very, very similar to that seen at Eskay Creek. We've put out some pictures here recently of core that we've been seeing. Yes, it's not assayed yet. It's going to take a little patience to get the assays back, but the visuals on it are remarkably similar to what was seen at Eskay Creek, the old Eskay Creek mine, and now Skeena's project. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing that all the way down to C10, which is remarkable. So there's, I'd say concrete evidence now that the VMS systems continue in that direction. Also exciting, up in the northeast part of the property, where we did our stream sediment sampling last year and identified a very robust anomaly. We followed up on the area that was highlighted by the SkyTEM. This was an area that really lit up as being a conductive feature, likely associated with either mudstones or sulfides. And we've determined that it does appear to be sulfide related. It also appears to be in the right stratigraphic position, mm-hmm, to the Eskay Creek deposit and everything else we're seeing down at TV Jeff. So it's just it's phenomenal to see a property-wide picture of, mm-hmm, multiple VMS systems emerge through this work. It's going to take a lot of patience to get all the assays back. 35,000 meters of core is no small undertaking. But I think at the end of this, we're going to see some very, very, very promising results, similar to those that were seen last year.
Mm-hmm. So, I guess through the winter, December, January, February, something like that, we might start to see some things come back. But I think it's important that people, I'm looking at a map of your property right now. TV and Jeff are a little ways apart. And as I recall in the past, you thought that might be one occurrence, single system. Is that still in your thinking, possibly?
That's correct. Some of this drilling that I just mentioned that we'll call it wildcat drilling, mm-hmm, is testing those peripheral sulfide targets that likely bridge or link the two systems together. I think at this point, John and the team there feel confident that they can see stratigraphic similarity or connection between the two systems, which is really encouraging. One of the other things that was found recently, we talked about in the most recent news release, is that they're seeing mineralization up section at both TV and Jeff.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about this before where, you know, TV and Jeff were in a position, a stratigraphic position, somewhat lower than the classic Eskay Creek deposit.
Mm-hmm.
But it's,
mm-hmm.
it's more typical of what Skeena calls their lower and even lower mudstones. All right, so we're kind of down in that realm right now, but they've been working their way up section at both TV and Jeff, and they found what appears to be probably the contact mudstone or something of that ilk a bit higher up.
Mm.
And some of the more recent work on the ground as far as traverses across that area, as mm-hmm. well as some of the recent drilling, show that the VMS systems continue up section. So to answer your question, yes, we're going to have enough drilling here soon to say how these systems connect with one another, as well as what lies above both of them.
And then the distance between TV and Jeff on the north and C10, I mean, it's not to say those are connected necessarily, but as you pointed out, these VMS deposits generally come in clusters, so you could see one system or several systems, I suppose, more likely, right? Possibly.
That's correct. In the VMS camp, what you usually see is that there are discrete horizons. And, you know, think about the seafloor. When these things are coming out, they need a period of quiescence on the seafloor bottom so the sulfides can accumulate. And what you're really looking for when you're exploring VMS systems are those periods of quiescence in the sedimentary section. And what we see is that there are indeed multiple horizons. There's probably certainly two now and perhaps even three discrete horizons that we can explore VMS. And, it's absolutely crystal clear that these VMS were occurring or erupting at the same time as one another, too. Like, you can see stratigraphic similarities between, like I said, TV and Jeff.
Mm-hmm. One more thing before I let you go. This was an announcement last year when SK acquired a 19.5% interest in Garibaldi Mining. I don't think it's something that most people paid too much attention to. But I've always kind of wondered about that. Is there anything you can tell us about that now, or is it it's just too early to comment on that?
Look, the Western Anticline, we've talked about the structural thesis behind the Eskay area and why we think there is potential on Garibaldi ground for this style of mineralization. And our interest that we acquired through the transaction with Eric Sprott is mainly so that we have exposure to that. But
okay.
We have not pursued that further. We just know that, hey, that's some very prospective ground on the Garibaldi side.
Yeah. Well, indeed, you certainly have your platter full with what you already have. So I just had to ask if there was anything new about that. Anything else you'd like to add? And how well-funded is the company now?
Look, the company has the money it needs for this current program. It is quickly drilling away. I'd say by October 16th to the 30th, somewhere in that window, is probably when we're going to shut things down. The crew is going to have to literally catch up with a huge backlog of core and logging. But, you know, we're going to be patient. I think the company will have some news in terms of update here very shortly. And given that Thomas Monicky was up recently, I'm going to get a download of what he thinks is going on when he gets back to Colorado here, and hopefully get some exciting stories out to the market here.
Well, that'd be nice. We're certainly looking forward to it. But patience is required in this sector, that's for sure, especially these days when you have to wait so long to get your assays back. But that patience can be richly rewarded, especially if you're sticking with good projects, no doubt about that. So, Quentin, thank you so much for spending time with us again. Always great to have you.
Thank you.
All right, folks, so we do have to go to break now, but don't go away, because when we come back, Kevin Smith and Tavi Costa of Crescat Capital will be with us for the first time. It's the company that Quentin Henning has just recently joined and will join formally. He's been advising them technically for some time. But, you know, this company has done extremely well. They've had, over the long term, they've done very well. But with their precious metals hedge fund, they've gained 235% over the last, over 12 months, ending July 31st. And that was despite several months here now of pretty weak markets for the gold sector. So this is a company I think you really want to pay some attention to. A lot of great information on their website, and some of which Quentin Henning is very much involved with. But anyway, right after the break when we come back, we'll be with Kevin Smith and Tavi Costa of Crescat Capital. So don't go away.
Lion Wine Metals is focused on high-grade gold in Fiji, led by legendary Canadian financier Walter Barakoff. Lion One is permitted for production and drilling for discoveries in one of the most exciting high-grade gold projects in the prolific South Pacific Ring of Fire. Lion One trades on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol LIO and on the OTCQX under the symbol LOMLF. Go to our website at liononemetals.com for more information about Lion One Metals and high-grade gold in Fiji.
Labrador Gold is an exploration company focused on its flagship Kingsway project, located in central Newfoundland Gold District. Labrador Gold's first phase drilling program has successfully identified high-grade gold mineralization, including a 3.6-meter intercept, grading 20.6 grams per ton gold, and 1.85 meters, grading 50.38 gram per ton gold. The company has approximately $35 million in the treasury and is led by a world-class team of CEO Roger Moss and technical advisors Sean Ryan and Quentin Henney.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to introduce Crescat Capital to you today. And to help you do that, help me do that, I've got Kevin Smith, who is the founder and chief investment officer, and Tavi Costa, who is the portfolio manager and, I guess, the macro designer of the company's macro view of the world and the market. So it's really good to have them with us. Now, I learned to know about Crescat Capital primarily because of Quentin Henning's involvement with the company as a technical advisor, because I've been just really a big fan of Quentin's for many years. I was drawn to the Crescat, to the Crescat Gets Active, it's called the Crescat Gets Activist on Gold and Silver video series, which are absolutely excellent. And if you're interested in this sector, I think it's one you're going to want to pay attention to. It's on their YouTube. It's on their YouTube channel, the Crescat's YouTube channel. As you know, Quentin has a sharp eye for talent and integrity, and he is quite selective in who he does business with. So it's not surprising that he chose to go to work with Crescat, given its stellar performance over many years. For example, one of the funds managed by Crescat is the Precious Metals Hedge Fund, which has gained 235% from its inception on August 1, 2020. Through July 31st, 2021. Now, that's pretty darn good considering the fact that we've had several months of pretty wretched, well, not wretched, but certainly not very robust markets for the junior sector. So the company was co-founded by Kevin and his wife, Linda, and Kevin is the chief investment officer, and he is joined, as I say, with Tavi Costa here with us today, who is the company's involved with the macro economic view of the company. Certainly both of them work on that as well. If you personally invest in the junior sector, I think this is really a company you want to pay attention to, Crescat, especially the Crescat Gets Activist on Gold and Silver videos. And so I really want to welcome Kevin and Tavi for joining me again today. Thanks, both of you, for joining me.
Thank you, Jay.
Thanks for having us.
You bet. And yet I should mention it's crescat.net, I believe, is your website, Crescat, C-R-E-S-C-A-T.net. Kevin, I just noted that, you know, that I just mentioned that 235% gain during the first year of the existence of the precious metals hedge fund, despite some weakness in the market, as you're painfully aware. How have you managed to do so well right out of the gate?
Well, thanks. That's really thanks to the assistance of Quentin Henny, first and foremost. I mean, we, like you mentioned, it's basically been a flat to down market for gold and silver in that 1 year performance that we've had since we launched the fund. But we've been able to do so well because we've been focused, number one, on the exploration side of the segment of the industry where we think there's a tremendous amount of value, first of all, to get to initiate positions, but also a lot of value to be created as we get involved with many companies that are involved in making new discovery of gold and silver. And with Quentin helping us direct our funds in an activist sort of way so we can actually get money to these companies to put to actually do drilling and make discovery, we have been able to generate those returns. And primarily it came from helping companies get money to make some big new discoveries. And that those are companies like SK Mining, mm-hmm. El Oro Resources, and Newfound Gold, just three of at least a dozen of our companies that had excellent drill results in the last year and have been creating value in the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no doubt about it. And in a lot of your presentations, you talk about the Lassonde curve. It is during that discovery phase when really a lot of percentage gains are made. And then you go into the orphan period and things slow down a little. And then you get into the time frame where you know, the successful companies then probably exceed their old highs. Hopefully they do. But you're primarily engaged in that. This fund is primarily engaged in the exploration sector, which, of course, is Quentin Henning's strength. So, it's really a great model. I think you've had somebody that's as good as he is to work with. And also, you say activist, it means you are actively involved. And I think a lot of the companies pay a great deal of attention to Quentin's ideas and his ability to interact with their technical people, with the company's technical people, with their geoscientists is really, really what makes this work, I think.
Absolutely. Quentin's expertise is really key in all of this. He's been in the industry for at least 30 years and knows a lot about discovery. And when the companies, really are eager to listen to him and we can be involved in that way. Activism to us means a bunch of different things. One of them is certainly Quentin's active involvement with the companies. It's also his involvement with helping to tell the story.
Yes.
And it's our ability to put a significant chunk of capital into these companies too, whereby we can get a significant stake in what are small cap and micro cap stocks often, where we can get anywhere between 5% and up to 20% of the shares of the outstanding shares of these companies on a partially diluted basis, including the warrants that we're able to strike as part of the deals. And we get involved in pipe deals, which are private placements in public securities, mm-hmm. also some pre-IPO situations. By investing in the private placements in the public securities, we're able to often come in at a discount to the public price and get warrants as part of the transaction. And those are just some of the extra kickers that we're able to have inside of this hedge fund strategy.
Mm-hmm. Well, for sure, and I should mention it just briefly because I think we want to focus primarily on the gold and silver sectors and the exploration sectors. But it should be pointed out that Kevin, your firm has done very well over the years. You have a global macro hedge fund, and you have a long short hedge fund, and especially I think the long short hedge fund shows a 491% gain since May 1st, 2000, if I'm reading this correctly, and I mean, that's pretty good because I don't know how many guys have tried to, go short and have lost their shirts. I mean, it's just been a horrible thing to try to do. But I guess what you do is you you move it around. I mean, it's not just short. So how do you determine when you're basically short and when you're basically long? I don't know if this is a question for either of you.
I'll let Tavi chime in since I've been doing a lot of the talking. Go ahead, Tavi.
Well, I would say that the most important part that we try to focus on is looking for pair trades and ideas that are secular moving. In this case, in today's environment where we believe we're entering a long-term inflationary setup for the markets, and you look at the investment alternatives universe of pretty much any stock or corporate bond or treasuries that actually yield less than inflation expectations, when you are in that environment, you start thinking about the flows out of very crowded investments towards something that has been out of favor, such as commodities. Mm-hmm. And so that's where we came up with this idea of really implementing the commodities to equity ratio. We don't know what's going to cause this ratio to rise, if it's commodities that will outperform significantly, or will be equity markets that will perhaps reach a reckoning moment given the valuations where we are when it comes to the business cycle and or calculations of issues and this mismatch of fundamentals and the reality of prices today. So mm-hmm. I think that matching the two opportunities is really something we've done in the past, and we enjoy having the two asymmetric bets in both sides of the portfolio. And then we add some other things, such as we have shorts in the Chinese currency. We have shorts in the Hong Kong dollar as parts of perhaps you call it an insurance play. We don't have to necessarily be right about those, but if we are, those make up a whole performance for the year. So it's almost like a basket of very asymmetric opportunities that we find in the markets, and that is one way to be positioned.
And your global macro hedge fund has also performed well. I see 580% since January 1st, 2006. So I guess maybe, Kevin, you can tell people these are hedge funds and the entry level, because they are, relatively modest as hedge funds go at different levels. Would you care to comment on that, the precious metals hedge fund, the long-short hedge fund, and the global macro hedge fund?
Sure. The Global Macro Hedge Fund has been our flagship fund since we launched it really in 2006. In the last year since we launched the Precious Metals Fund, that one has actually grown to become even larger in just 1 year, which is pretty crazy. But it's testament to the exciting things going on in that sector and in that fund. Both of those two funds, the Global Macro and the Precious Metals, have a $250,000 minimum. Mm-hmm. They are for accredited investors only. They are true hedge funds in that sense. Mm-hmm. And then our Long Short Fund, which has an even longer track record, that was started kind of at the peak of the tech bubble in 2000. And that one has a $100,000 minimum, and that's focused just more on long short equity.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of tech bubbles, maybe Tavi, you can comment on that. I know that your letter that you sent out to your shareholders or to your investors, you did a comparison of the tech bubble in 2000 with the one we have now. Would you care to comment on that?
Sure. This comparison was actually made by Kevin, but I can certainly chime in and tell you a little bit about what the research looked like. And the question really was, how much of the enterprise value of those businesses back in the tech bubble were relative to the GDP at the time. And what we found is that today we're at much more extreme levels when we look at the top companies in the tech sector. Tech companies are very profitable, but are actually less profitable on a yield basis relative to what inflation really is. Wow. We think that this issue of what security selection has looked like in the last few years with the focus on top-line improvements will perhaps shift away as cost of capital begins to rise caused by inflationary forces picking up. And therefore, we think that the higher focus on profitability and cheaper stocks and fundamental analysis and value investing principles will actually take place again. And so why we think that natural resource industries will become a bigger part of the economy as we move towards a new regime in the markets. And so that's we are very concerned about the valuations in the tech sector, very concerned about valuations in the market as a whole. And we think that there is certainly a risk for deflationary shock, believe it or not, given the fact that liquidity has so far been very large coming from central banks. But certainly we are in a moment where the Federal Reserve is strapped. And so what are they going to do? There is a possibility of taking the path of least resistance, which would be the inflationary side. And so we have an inflationary a portfolio focus with the exploration names in the portfolio and the commodity-related companies with some shorts paired with it as part of that risk. And who knows the exogenous shock that could perhaps create a liquidity crash in equity markets.
Yeah, who knows? And how do you prepare for it is a bigger question. How do you, in your portfolio selection, how do you prepare for that exogenous shock that might just, take the floor out from underneath the markets?
Well, I certainly have a view on what the exogenous shock could look like. I think it's coming from China. When we look at the credit imbalances in China, historically, we've never seen any economy to get to the level that we've seen China with over $50 trillion in its banking assets. And so clearly we have a credit bubble that tends to implode and perhaps could potentially have issues in the global economy as well. As we know, we've had a CCP. The CCP has been cracking down on domestic companies. We've had some issues with ADRs, companies in the U.S., and the change in price levels of Chinese securities have certainly been linked to a lot of the macro data in the U.S., which suggests that we may see a deceleration of growth in the next months or so, and perhaps even a correction in equity markets in the U.S. And so we're very focused on that. It's one of the risks that I don't think the Federal Reserve has its hands on, and that could potentially become a much bigger problem. So there's a few buckets of shorts that we look at. We look at the very high multiple names, the high flying names, and most of them are in the tech space, software space, and so forth. But there's quite a lot of other issues that we see with margins getting squeezed with our views about wages and salaries growing. And so we're looking for companies that don't have much of the buying power and selling power, I would say, and could perhaps get a squeeze into margins issues in the following months and years. And so I think those two buckets are very important right now, and we use our quant models to select those in order to have a basket of high potential shorts here.
Yeah. Well, we just had Michael Oliver on our first segment today, and he's also getting a bit queasy about the high-tech names, the big names, the guys that have been carrying the NASDAQ and the S&P primarily on their backs for some time, and he sees also some possibilities there of a decline in an equity market decline. What about cryptocurrencies? What are your thoughts on that? I haven't really taken the time to see if you've commented on it, but either of you want to talk about cryptocurrencies? Is there any place in your world for that?
I'll let Kevin comment on it.
Yeah. I'll give my comments first. The crypto world for me has always been I've been a real skeptic because I look at it as someone creating some software out of thin air, and that's going to become money all of a sudden. I mean, we like gold and silver because it has thousands of years of history as a tangible asset, as money that central banks own, that people own and trade with. However, there's some credence. And what's interesting about the crypto world, and especially the Bitcoiners, is that they've really adopted all of the same, global macro narrative of the gold bugs. That they call it Bitcoin. Their symbol is gold, and it's in limited supply, even though it's just there's an unlimited number of competing cryptocurrencies. So I think in general it's raising more awareness for the issues of fiat money and debt and the inevitable inflation and devaluation of the dollar and other fiat currencies that we're likely to experience. And if the crypto crowd wants to adopt that same narrative, that's okay. But I think it's also a big sign of the speculation that's out there in the market at large and all the money that is sloshing around that the the Fed and the government has created through the fiscal and monetary stimulus. And so we really need to be careful here, especially at these insane valuations. There's a lot of speculation in the markets, and I think there's a lot of risk in crypto. And if someone has made a lot of money in crypto, we have investors that have made a lot of money in crypto, and they've been peeling it off and putting some with us. And I think, you know, that's it's a good mix to have some traditional precious metals in your portfolio too, if you're a crypto fan.
No doubt about it. You commented also in your latest letter about gold. Relative to commodities, gold has been disappointing for those of us gold bugs compared to the commodity sector overall. Would either of you care to comment on that? Why the weakness in gold when we have all this inflation, rising inflation levels that are taking everybody by surprise?
And now that one is one of Tavi's charts, so he should definitely comment on that.
Yeah, well, I think the idea is yes, gold looks relatively cheap when you look at compared to the monetary base, money supply, equities, but even more importantly, is it looks undervalued when you look at relative to other places such as commodities as a whole. And so that's for me what it shows is that we saw since 2018 in August, we saw an appreciation of gold all the way to August of 2020. That went up all the way to about 75%. And then since then, we've seen sort of a consolidation period. And I think that a lot of that move was signaling what we saw in regards to the fiscal and monetary disorder when it comes to central banks coming to rescue of the equity markets. Now, since then, we've seen this idea of tapering sort of becoming more popular. And I think that has partially hurt gold, and on top of the issues with cryptocurrencies that have, I would say, still been getting a lot of momentum in regards to capital flows. But I think that at the end of the day, central banks buy gold. And so if we see a beginning of issues in regards to central banks needing to improve the international reserves of those countries, which I think it's going to happen, it's going to become a trend where central banks will have to start buying gold in order to improve the quality of those currencies that are backed by international reserves. I think that that's going to be one of the things that creates a demand for precious metals. So we still think that we are in a secular bull market for precious metals. We haven't seen a lot of the late cycle signs, such as the M&A cycle in the miners. We haven't seen the CapEx growth to levels that are unsustainable. We haven't seen the leverage ratios move significantly higher for the miners. So everything looks fundamentally cheap in different parts of the industry. And I think that that's a big sign of where we are today. And I think this is just a sell-off and an incredible opportunity to be looking for high-quality projects to put money to work.
Yeah, we've seen gold at the bottom in this cycle, just a bit around $1,100. It's gone up to $1,800 right about now. But I guess we haven't really seen anything like a blow-off phase that you would expect in the late part of a bull market. And you have to wonder. But it is. What about the gold shares then? Do you anticipate the gold shares should, I would think, because of the leverage factor, should outperform the bullion then at some point here?
I think when you look at where we are in the cycle for precious metals mining shares, and especially when it comes to the junior mining stocks, which is the exploration sector, you know, we've effectively been through a 10-year bear market that only retested its lows in March of 2020 with the COVID lows. And here just in the past couple of months, we've had another smackdown. We called it blood in the streets when it was March 2020. Yeah. And that was a great buying opportunity. But we kind of have another one of those blood in the streets moment here in terms of how the juniors have sold off on this idea that that inflation is transitory and that, you know, that the Fed's getting ready to taper anyway. And we think it is just still so early in a new market because the majors have underinvested in replacing their reserves, and they're going to have to go to the juniors if they want to increase their production, even if they want to maintain their production. And it's a very bullish setup for gold and silver in general, but for the junior miners, it's an incredible setup.
Yeah, and those majors are going to look for big deposits. And we know who has this model of go big or go home, don't we?
Indeed.
I think it's somebody
named one other than Quentin Henney knows how to find big, high-grade gold deposits.
Well, he's not interested if they're not big, I think, for the most part. So now with just about a minute left or so, if either of you would want to comment on this transitory issue. I mean, it seems to me if we went into a bear market, I mean, if we went into the stock market decline, we might see some of that. Or Tavi, you were mentioning any number of things that could happen, exogenous factors that could, you know, pull the floor out from under us. But maybe real quickly, if you'd like to just comment, what are your thoughts? Is this a transitory, of course, and it's not going to go up every month, but are we in a new stage like the 1970s of much higher inflation?
I have to comment here because I really do believe, and I think Tavi shares this belief, that we are that we're entering a stagflationary environment, not a deflationary environment. I mean, our bet is on inflation, but when you look at other stagflationary periods like the 70s and like that 73-74 bear market, we haven't seen one of those since 73-74. We kind of saw one in 01-02 when commodities started to take off and the tech bust happened, but 73-74, I mean, that was the killer. Go listen to Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger and hear them talk about those days, because it was brutal. And that's a time when large cap growth stocks can get pummeled and gold stocks and commodity stocks can take off to the upside at the same time. And so that's the type of market that we are in position for and that we envision. Tavi, do you have any quick comments on that?
I think you guys are about done, right? As I can see here. So I'll let my comments for another day.
Very good. Another day. Yeah. Well, thank you both of you for being with us today. It's really great to have you. Great to introduce you to our listeners. And I hope we can have you back again sometime in the not too distant future. So thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Jay.
All right, folks. So that is it for today. Next week, Dr. Quentin Henning will be back once again with us to talk about Laurel Resources. And Alistair McLeod will join us to talk about the surging inflation and the dollar's debt trap. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
NV Gold Corporation, trading under NVX on the TSX and NVGLF on the OTCQB, is a gold exploration company focused on uncovering the next multi-million ounce gold deposit in Nevada with an aggressive exploration season ahead in 2021, a tight share structure, strong management ownership, key strategic investors, a globally recognized technical team, report coverage from industry gold experts, and a strong treasury. Visit NVGoldCorp.com to learn more on this exciting story.